I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we start today with another case of sexual assault in the military, at least allegations. An unidentified Army sergeant whose job is handling sexual assault cases at Fort Hood in Texas is being investigated on sexual abuse allegations. 10 days ago, Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Krasinski, who led sexual assault prevention programs for the entire Air Force, was arrested on charges of groping and battering a woman in a parking lot. His police mugshot showing his face scratched and bruised filled television screens as the Pentagon released a report finding that sexual assault in the military jumped by 35% in the last 2 years, despite programs to stop it. What does all of this mean for the military? Juliet Kayyem is national security columnist for the Boston Globe. She served in the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama. And Juliet, yet another headline. This is an unnamed Army sergeant, but again, someone who was in charge of reducing sexual assault cases now being charged with sexual assault.
Yes, I would say the irony is sort of mind-boggling at this stage, because it is the second in 2 weeks. To his credit, Secretary Hagel almost immediately announced that they are going to do a review of the personnel who are filling these offices, these sexual assault prevention offices that were created as the numbers of sexual assault cases got higher and higher, and as it became clear that women did not feel comfortable coming forward because of the chain of command structure within the military. It really, at this stage, you're not quite sure what to do next. There is going to be legislation proposed tomorrow by a group of female senators to take all of these cases, the sexual assault and harassment cases, out of the military, out of the military justice system, and find another way to provide redress and independence for these women.
Well, let's explain. This is Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, the Democrat, who says she's going to introduce this legislation that would change military law. And as we've been learning or relearning in the past few weeks, right now you can have someone prosecuted in the military, but a military commander can overturn that prosecution. We've heard many cases of what seem like clear-cut prosecutions of assault, and then the military commander has the right to overturn that. So what would the change be?
So that's exactly right, just describing it that way. And the reversal of a guilty verdict is not appealable. So you can imagine a woman goes through court of her peers, of her military peers. The guy is found guilty. Often he might be a colleague or even someone she reports to, and then someone higher than him overturns it. The new rules would take a certain class of cases, and we haven't seen the legislation yet, of sexual assault cases and take them out of what's that command authority. In other words, either there's two different proposals. One is take all of those cases out of the military justice system and put them in a civilian legal system, or prohibit commanders from overturning guilty verdicts. Secretary Hagel prefers that the second one because, of course, as a form of military justice, he wants to keep as many cases within the military justice system simply because it's the system that has worked for the military for over 200 years. But I have to say, after yesterday's disclosures about the Army, it is going to be hard for the Pentagon to say that they have this under control.
Well, again, this is the Army sergeant, and I should say he's not been charged, but there are allegations of sexual abuse. And again, his job is to handle the sexual assault cases at Fort Hood in Texas. He's not being named because charges have not been filed yet. But you mentioned that Defense Secretary Hagel is ordering the armed services to retrain and re-screen these people who are supposed to be running. They're called sexual assault prevention officers, but there are thousands and there are tens of thousands of military recruiters. How long will it take to retrain and rescreen all of them?
That will take a couple months, clearly. They've already gone through a screening and a review process, and it's just not clear how the Army officer or the Air Force officer from last week are actually getting through these programs. They may not be strong enough. And what Hagel also has sort of hanging over him, if I could put it that way, is today, on the 15th, the services, the different services are required to provide to him their detailed plans for better integration of women into combat roles. So he has a lot going on with gender and the armed services this week. Those plans were required by the January rule that ended combat exclusion for women. And I have to say, those plans ought to and hopefully take into account this other scandal, the sexual harassment scandals, because it's one thing to open the doors to women in combat, but if those doors are opening to exceptionally hostile environments, more women will not enter the armed services. And, you know, one way to look at this is the only way that this is really going to be cured is by having more women enter the services and then get promoted to positions in which this kind of behavior is unacceptable.
Well, let's talk about that chicken and egg, because, as you say, today's the day that the branches of the service have to submit their plans for allowing women into combat, which was a huge sea change, a huge shift in the decision making of the military. But certainly that doesn't mean a shift in the culture. And there are some people pointing to the huge number of sexual abuse cases, not just against women, but actually more against men in the military, as proof, though, when it comes to women, that women should not be in combat. You say what?
I say that's called the proximity debate, and it is actually promoted by a number of people who say that as women have gotten more integrated into the military, that's why we have the sexual harassment problem. It is debunked by almost every experience of other countries in the integration of women. Look, the military is under tremendous stress right now. Sexual harassment and assault are the consequence of the stresses of the end of wars, long deployments, an economic crisis that's impacting the military. I'm not excusing it, but to argue that women's presence is somehow, making these men act in ways that they wouldn't otherwise is an insult to the men as well as the women. So proximity is going to happen in our military unless you're willing to say no woman in the military, which is a unlawful, but also
unlikely.
Yeah. And so, you know, now we just have to figure out if you're going to have more women in the military in positions of leadership, how do you make sure it is an environment in which they're thriving and not subject to the kind of abuse that we're seeing in the numbers?
Juliet Kayyem, national security columnist for the Boston Globe. Juliet, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, we want to touch down in Cleveland, where it has been an incredible 10 days. As everyone knows, last week, three women missing for about a decade were found alive, along with a child one of them had in captivity. Last night, Ariel Castro's lawyers say he will plead not guilty to charges of kidnapping and rape in that case. And then today, just as Cleveland was taking in the news of the release and the upcoming plea, prosecutors announced the arrest of Hernandez Warren in one of the city's most high-profile unsolved murder cases, the 1984 killing of 14-year-old Gloria Pointer. At a press conference today, Gloria's mother, Yvonne, spoke about her fight to find a suspect.
For half of my life, I determined this morning, I have been actively involved with finding out what happened to Gloria. Over the years, people would always ask, why don't you give it up? But it's something inside just would not let it rest.
Almost 30 years. And the district attorney's office said today that it was a question from a reporter that prompted them to dig back into old evidence. That reporter is Rachel DeSell of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. We had scheduled her to be on our program today. Rachel, what was it that you asked the district attorney's office?
Well, basically, I had gotten an email from Gloria Pointer's, or from Yvonne Pointer's sister, asking me if I could help find out what evidence had been tested and maybe if there was any evidence that could be tested again. We had been doing a series of stories here in Cleveland on untested rape kits, and I think that prompted some questions from her. Yvonne also weighed in and kind of went over with me what she thought had been done, and she believed there was, DNA profiles or something in CODIS from her daughter's case. I know that DNA technology has changed so much throughout the years. It's gotten more sensitive. You can extract DNA from evidence that you could not extract DNA from years ago. So I basically did what any reporter does. I asked a couple questions. I asked the medical examiner's office, and I asked the county prosecutor's office, you know, if if all of the tests had been done, or if any retesting had been done since, you know, DNA technology had advanced. And I didn't really hear back from them until I heard yesterday that on April 26th, just a couple days after I had contacted them, that they had found something that they thought might yield some leads in this case.
Yeah, they found DNA. And they called you to say, we're going to embarrass you at today's press conference because we're going to credit you with asking us that. But how are people there reacting to now another arrest, Hernandez Warren? Is this someone, again, he's only been accused and arrested at this point, but we're presuming that they found some DNA evidence. How are people reacting to another person in their midst arrested in this old case?
Well, most people in the community would be familiar with Yvonne Poynter, Gloria's mother. You know, she works for the city, and she has been the support for countless victims of crime in the city. She goes out to crime scenes. She helps victims. She pushes for change, you know, when victims' rights are at issue. So I think so many people felt completely overwhelmed for her because she's pushed this case at every chance she can get, just searching for answers for nearly 30 years now, and so to see her finally get some answers is pretty amazing. It's thrilling almost.
Well, and sadly, most cities have a Yvonne Poynter who have become activists after their children disappear, but I'm wondering, what are people saying? Because in this case, it took a reporter to nudge officials to go back and retest evidence with new technology. In another case, yes, the police are credited for going to the house where the women in Cleveland were being held. They ran into the police arms, but one of those women police thought was just a runaway, didn't follow her case. I mean, are people asking some questions about, do we have the right follow-up and pursuit of these stories?
I mean, sure, we're reporters, so we're always asking questions. You know, I think in either of these cases, there's no doubt that police and the local police and the FBI put thousands of hours into them. But I think it just shows the power of the community being involved and having a strong, you know, news media to constantly ask questions and just, you know, double check things. That's what we do. You know, we're a check on the system. And also, I mean, you have to credit Gloria's family. They continue to reach out to people and continue to push. I mean, I would not have asked any question had they not so passionately, you know, asked me to do anything I could.
Well, Yvonne Poynter was one of the crisis team members that helped the kidnapping victims who were found last week. This is Gloria's mother, and today she renewed her call to other families not to give up hope.
To all of the families out there of missing children and unsolved homicides, please don't give up. You can see after almost 30 years, there is miracles that's being wrought. So what we want you to do is just keep hope alive and that there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Again, that's Yvonne Poynter, the mother of Gloria Poynter, who was killed just a little under 30 years ago. But her man has been accused in her murder, and Rachel DeSell of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the reporter who told officials, go back and see if you can test some evidence. Rachel, thanks so much for telling us the story.
Thanks for having me.
And all of this, the roiling of emotions in Cleveland has gotten people across the country thinking, how do we protect our kids? Some thoughts in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. The discovery of the Cleveland women, Amanda Berry, Michelle Knight, and Gina DeJesus, after a decade in captivity, has made parents think about their own kids. We know that about 115 children a year are kidnapped by people with no ties to the family, and most of them, sadly, never make it home. But 58,000 children are abducted every year by non-family members who know the child, and most of them are found. We're long past the phrase stranger danger. People have realized that, first of all, children don't think of someone, say, dressed as a police officer as a stranger. But what do we do with the knowledge that the father of a childhood friend could be an abductor? That's what police suspect in the Cleveland case. Nancy McBride is safety director at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. She joins us. And Nancy, what's the main message you want to send to parents?
I think the main message, Robin, is don't think that just because your kids are older that they are armed with all the information and judgment and experience they need to make sound safety decisions, because sometimes that isn't true.
In a case like Cleveland, you had allegedly the kidnapper was the father of the of a friend of the one of the young women taken. Another young woman was 20 years old. What does this tell you? I mean, one thing I'm hearing is it's never too late to tell kids about getting into cars, but how do parents avoid this?
Well, I think what you tell your children is you don't get in a car without talking about it with me first and making sure that we have an agreement about whose cars you can get into.
Yeah, but tell us more about how parents can instruct their children about what's possible.
Well, first and foremost, don't use fear as a motivator. Kids live in the real world, so they know it's a scary place. So what you want to do is have a conversation with your child in a pretty benign type of a setting. Let's say you're having dinner and you decide you want to talk about safety, and also be prepared to answer your child's questions as openly as you can. And then make sure you've got a set of rules you want to impart to your child, and then after that, practice them.
That's key, because as we've seen in those chilling videos that came out a while back on some of the magazine shows, a parent can tell their child everything, and then a parent is put in a room with a two-way mirror and watches as their child goes and does exactly what they told them not to do.
Right, and I think that brings in the whole, it's so much easier to believe in the scary weirdo hiding behind a tree than to know that a lot of these predators are very nice-looking people. They're very patient. So we've got to teach our kids, don't fall for the tricks. That's very important.
So what would you suggest after you have the conversation with the child about, you know, we don't want you taking candy from people or mm-hmm. getting into cars to go look for a puppy? I promise you, if there's a puppy that's lost, the parent will know about it first, things like that. Do you then go out and practice? Do you try to trick your child by having friends do run-throughs with you? I mean, how do you do this?
I don't really believe in tricking kids. I think the best way to do the practicing is to do the what-if scenarios with your children. Set up the what-if somebody came up to you and said that they had a puppy who was lost, would you help them? And go a little farther. I actually had a mom tell me that her little boy said no to the puppy, but when she asked the question, what if he had a missing kitten, the little boy said yes, because kittens need more help than puppies. So you've really, really got to think like a child in those situations, and remember that kids are pretty literal thinkers.
What about, I mean, some parents are thinking maybe if we had code words that only the adults that I want to give a ride to my child will know. What about that?
I'm not a real fan of gimmicks because I don't think we need them. I think the message to our kids is if anyone makes you feel sad, scared, or confused, you get out of that situation as quickly as possible and tell a trusted adult. I think the problem with code words is some kids just can't keep secrets. So they've got the word in their head and they can't wait to go out and tell everybody what it is. And it also allows somebody who's pretty savvy to start trying to engage in a conversation by guessing the code words. The predators know about code words.
And back to this idea of somebody just picking up a child and offering them a ride seems so innocent. And we understand that when you researched missing children, 72% involved the suspect driving a vehicle. Does it still pay to tell kids you don't have to get near the car? What are things to tell kids about cars in particular?
Absolutely. That is the key number one message. If anybody tries to get a child in a car, the only job that child has is to get away as quickly as possible and tell a trusted adult. We're going to have to get rid of this whole polite thing, because we've taught kids to be polite to adults, but in this situation, you're not only not polite, you're not even having the conversation. So never, ever get in the car. Because once you're in the car, everything changes.
So it could be the father of a friend. Don't get in.
No. I mean, why is he going by offering a ride anyway? I mean, seriously. It's like adults asking kids for directions. If you really want to go somewhere, do you ask a kid? So if it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for somebody to be doing this, then, you know, why get in the car with them?
Well, this is so difficult, but if a child has, and an older child who might be old enough to realize, I've made a mistake, what then?
Well, what we're teaching kids, obviously, at the National Center is recognition and avoidance. If you can't avoid it, then you do everything in your power to get out of it, meaning you fight, you kick, you yell, you scream, you make as much of a ruckus, get as much attention as you possibly can. And in 83% of the 8,000 cases we looked at, that's exactly what the kids did, and that's exactly how they got away.
What do you think the Cleveland story reflects? How many children do you think it might be possible are locked up in a house somewhere? We just had a story here in Massachusetts where a sex ring was broken open. These were, again, women who had been lured into homes. It's a horrible thought, but it would also be the good news for parents. Do you think it's possible there are more cases like this?
We absolutely positively do. I mean, we're starting to come up with a list now. You've got Elizabeth Smart on that list. You've got J.C. Dugart. You've got Sean Hornsby. There are kids who have been captive for years who come home alive. So it isn't always that tragic, horrible ending.
Well, I guess that's even more important to tell kids, no matter what anyone tells you, we love you, and scream your head off and get out.
Right. And should they be in that situation, they also need to know that we love you and we'll never stop looking.
Nancy McBride, Safety Director of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, that's quite something. What do you think? Too much to tell your teen not to get in the car with an adult they know? Or are you resigned to that? Let us know your thoughts at hereandnow.org. Latest news is next, Here and Now. Honeybees have been making headlines because of their dwindling numbers. Some blame pesticides, some drought. But another bee, that hybrid of an African bee and a honeybee that escaped from a lab in Brazil in 1956, is also making headlines in Arizona. A week ago, a rock climber and his dog were both killed by a swarm. This past weekend, five hikers, including a six-year-old child, were stung up to 150 times each. Three of the hikers were hospitalized after a helicopter rescue. And in Tucson, a woman just walking down a street suffered more than 200 stings. Mazda Shirazi is medical director of the Arizona Poison and Drug Information Center in Tucson. Dr. Shirazi, remind us again about these hybrid bees.
Well, they are a bit more aggressive. Although they produce less venom per bee, they tend to swarm when they attack. So it's not one or two that attack. They're hundreds that attack. And they tend to be tenacious, as the story about the hikers showed, that whenever the helicopter was over ahead of the hikers, the wind would blow these bees away, but as soon as the helicopter would move away, the swarm will return and try to attack again.
Yeah, and what happens, by the way, if somebody should find themselves stung by several bees?
To find shelter. Mm-hmm. First of all, they tend to go for face, head, and try to actually go into any orifice that they can fit. So they try to go into the ears, up to the nose. They even try to go under the eyelids.
Oh, boy.
So if one can get into a shelter, that's the best thing.
Well, and we read of this one rock climber dying. A six-year-old child had to be brought to the hospital because of these stings. I mean, when is the point when you've had too many stings? What happens to you physically?
Well, you're looking at actually two or three different reactions. The honeybee venom has specific content that's muscle toxic and also heart toxic. So an individual can break down their muscles, they can start to break down their red blood cells, and immediately could start having problems. But then there is also a delayed toxicity associated with massive envenomation by bees. And that tends to occur 12 to 24 hours later, and there is cardiac effects. So heart, they can either cause a heart attack by causing vasospasm of coronaries or actual causing myocardial cell death, so killing the muscle of the heart. They also can cause kidney, liver, and blood coagulation problems. So this becomes specifically a concern when you have hundreds of bees. But what we're seeing is that there are actually, now that more and more of these stings are occurring, we're seeing more and more syndromes or constellation of symptoms and disease that can be described depending on number of bee stings that one got.
Well, look, Arizona is for people who love the outdoors. So are people pulling back? Is there something you can spray on to avoid these bees?
Well, I'll be honest with you. There are some sprays such as DEET that has been sprayed, but it does not seem to work with the swarm when they attack.
So what would you say to people?
Well, I would say if you go hiking in Arizona, they should wear long sleeve shirts and some cool long sleeve pants. I would carry something, a hat or something with a netting in my pocket to be able to protect my face so that I can try to at least get away and get someplace that has shelter. But realistically, this has not affected the love of the nature in, among the people in Arizona and those who come to visit us. Because although these make the news, these are stuff that occurs every year. Last year there was, in 2012, about 640 attacks. If you look at the number that was more than 50 bee stings, that number actually dwindles to about 12.
Scary, but not that rampant.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. It can happen, but again, the chances are low.
That's Mazda Shirazi, Medical Director for the Arizona Poison and Drug Information Center in Tucson, Arizona. Dr. Shirazi, thank you.
Thank you.
And note to myself, pack hat for hiking with netting in my beautiful Arizona. Back in 30 seconds here and now. A month ago today, two bombs exploded near the finish line of the Boston Marathon, killing three people, injuring more than 260. Days later, an MIT police officer was killed, allegedly by the bomb suspects. And later that night, a car chase, an incredible shootout in the Boston suburb of Watertown. One of the suspects died, the other fled and was eventually captured. It's still hard to believe, harder still, when you hear firsthand accounts. And here now is Bruce Gellerman has one from one of the first police officers on the scene that night.
Laurel Street is in your typical workaday Watertown neighborhood. It's lined with one- and two-family homes, perhaps smaller yards and maybe fewer trees than on many streets. But take a closer look, and you'll see evidence that will forever make Laurel Street unique.
If you look down the fence line, you can see all the bullet holes coming down the fence line, a couple in the tree. And I was reloading.
Wow, look at that.
Yeah, this house got hit 10 times.
Sergeant John McClellan has been on the Watertown Police Force for 23 years, and never has he had a night like the one that started late April 18th. Then again, according to the federal ATF, until then, neither had any other police officer in the U.S.
You know, in America, this has never, ever happened in the history of the United States, ever. No officers have ever taken bombs thrown at them in a gunfight. You can't even think that through, you know, so we were lucky that it worked out the way it did, and you know, the good guys are where they should be and the bad guys are where they should be, as far as I'm concerned.
Sergeant McClellan has a straightforward worldview. There are good guys and there are bad guys. But for those of us who saw first responders in action after the Boston bombings and the Watertown shootout, there are people like John McClellan. This is his story.
Watertown Control. Watertown Control, all units. Please clear the radio with the exception of 468.
That's Sergeant McClellan on the police scanner. He was born and raised in Watertown. Just before midnight on April 18th, he was working his shift as night patrol supervisor when Cambridge PD radioed to say a hijacked Mercedes SUV was heading his way.
Being the patrol supervisor, when you have an incident like that, I'm the only one who's supposed to talk on the radio to the dispatchers. Everything goes through me.
And now the vehicle's moving now, units. In the area of 89 Dexter.
Watertown officer Joe Reynolds hears McClellan on the scanner. Reynolds is just going off duty, but he sees the SUV in a green Honda turn off Dexter. Reynolds is the first on the scene. Sergeant McClellan is right behind.
I said, Joe, hold off. Don't pull it over until I get there. As I said that, the vehicles took a left-hand turn onto here, onto Laurel. They ended up down there about close to 100 yards down the street with Joe Reynolds about 30 feet behind them. I see a male exit the vehicle, arm raised, shooting position. I hear the pop, pop, pop.
Sergeant McClellan and Officer Reynolds take out their Glock handguns. Between them, they've got five clips. 67 bullets total.
So I'm shooting, and I have a shoulder mic, and I'm talking on the shoulder mic and shooting down range.
Shots fired.
I take a round right through the windshield. Right through my windshield, right through my headrest of my driver's side. But I reach down, I'm trying to get my patrol rifle, which is a civilian version of the M16. I tried two or three times, but I can hear the rounds hitting my vehicle.
Did you know who it was at this point?
We have no idea. We thought that it was just a carjacking, that, you know, when we pull these kids over, they're going to bail out and we're going to chase them and we're going to catch them and that's going to be it. It just turned out a little different.
To say the least, John McClellan releases the handbrake on his patrol car, puts it in drive, and jumps from the vehicle and hides behind a tree. The police car stops right next to the hijacked Mercedes SUV. The younger suspect throws clips of bullets to the older suspect, then unloads three backpacks from the Honda.
They come out from behind the Mercedes and engage the vehicle. They think someone's in it, and they're firing at it. Boom, 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 firing at the vehicle. At this point, they throw the first bomb. Boom. I said, what was that? You know, I get on the radio, and I actually said on the radio, bigger than an M80. I'm not sure what it was. That's when the second bomb goes off and throws it up, and it's a large pipe bomb.
McClellan hides behind one of the only trees on Laurel Street. It's just 3.5 minutes into the shootout. Sergeant Jeff Pugliese shows up. He's 10 feet from the older suspect. They exchange gunfire. The suspect runs out of ammunition and then starts charging Sergeant McClellan.
I'm out here, and I'm drawing down on him, and I said, I'm going to kill you, get on the ground. I'm going to shoot you, get on the ground. Now, I have an empty gun. I don't have any ammo at all. So I'm like, you know, I'm just bluffing him, hoping he's going to get down to the ground. He's not taking. He's coming right at me. Jeff Pugliese, the sergeant, jumps on his back. As soon as he jumps on his back, he just collapses him to the ground. The guy's been shot quite a few times, drops him to the ground. And then my only thought at that point was, this guy's throwing bombs at us. He's either strapped or he's got another one, or his brother's got a button. As soon as we get on him, he's going to blow us up. I'm like, no way. I couldn't let him do it by himself. The only thought running through my head is, you know, I'm the supervisor of this guy. I can't let this guy go by himself. I got to help him. So I jump on top, and I try to get his hand. He's got one arm, and I'm going for the other arm. And I hear, "Sarge, here he comes, watch out." And I look back and I see the lights of the Mercedes facing us. And the car just, it seemed like half a second it was on top of us. I go, "Jeff, here he comes, watch out." I push off the body. He pushes off the body and the brother runs, misses both of us and runs over his brother. He gets caught up underneath the car, drags him, as you can see, drags him about, I believe it was like 60 feet, and releases him. When he hits the cruiser, he hits up one of our cruisers and releases the body.
This is only part of Sergeant John McClellan's story from that night just about a month ago. There's a lot more. Immediately after the shootout, he and six other Watertown police officers who were in the thick of it went on leave for 2 weeks. They all received counseling, were debriefed by investigators, and are back on the job.
That report from Here and Now's Bruce Gellerman. And this note, today, exactly 38 years after he vanished, a Marine is being laid to rest. In 1975, Daniel Benedet was on a helicopter, shot down as it landed on a Cambodian island in a mission to save the crew of the Mayaguez, a merchant ship seized by Cambodian forces. President Ford spoke to the nation.
I have now received information that the vessel has been recovered intact and the entire crew has been rescued.
But what President Ford did not say was the crew was not rescued from that island. They'd already been released. Private Benedet was one of 13 Marines declared missing. The others were identified years ago, but Benedet's remains only recently. Today, exactly 38 years after he went missing, he is finally being laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. And to our young listeners, that's why those black and white missing in action flags still fly. You're listening to Here and Now. Summer movie season has begun. Iron Man 3 is dominating, though Star Trek Into Darkness may give it some competition later this week. We're going to have more on that film when we speak with Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry's son tomorrow. But speaking of devoted followings...
My hopes and dreams travel with you.
He'll be an outcast. I'll kill him.
How? He'll be a god to them.
That's a trailer from Man of Steel, which opens June 14th. It's just the latest incarnation of Superman, which was created in 1932 by Jerry Siegel, the son of Jewish immigrants in Cleveland. This year marks the 75th anniversary of Superman's first appearance in Action Comics, but he's been in comic books, TV and radio shows, and films ever since. Why? Well, you can find many answers in Larry Tye's terrific book, Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. In it, Larry tells us how actually two Jewish boys, Jerry and Joe Shuster, fending off bullies, if not in real life, in their stories, gave Superman life. Jerry Siegel with his idea, Joe Shuster with his drawings. How, like Moses, Superman was protected by his parents, was sent from the planet Krypton to Earth, losing his own father, or as my sister's bumper sticker reads, yes, Superman was adopted. And then he became a father figure for generations. Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero, comes out in paperback this week. We spoke with Larry when it was first published last year. Take us back to where Superman came from. Jerry Siegel, the creator.
What I'd love to take you back to is an afternoon in the early 1930s, 1932, in a used clothing store in a very seedy section of Cleveland, Ohio. And Jerry Siegel's father owned that store, and three guys come in and try on a suit and walk out without paying. And Jerry's dad tries to stop them. He has a massive heart attack, and he drops dead. The 17-year-old kid has lost his dad. He's lost his role model. And the only way that he can escape what happened to him with his dad, escape some of the tormenting that he faced since he was a little kid on the playground.
Because he was Jewish and he was an immigrant.
Because he was Jewish, yep. And he was a little too short. And every night he would escape to bed with a pen and a piece of paper. And one night, shortly after his dad died, he's escaping to bed and jotting down the story of this extraordinary character. That first story was about a robber holding up a guy who looked a whole lot like Jerry's dad, and this creature coming to rescue him, a creature that Jerry wished he could have been to have rescued his dad that day in the store. And this bereft kid is suddenly given a hero that can make up for some of his loss. Yeah. And there's never probably in the history of publishing been a more perfect coincidence between a hero being invented and America being at a moment when it needed a hero. We were in the middle of the Great Depression. We were about to go to war, and suddenly Jerry Siegel gives us the perfect hero to believe in.
Well, then you trace this incredible history. It's the history of the birth of comic books, really. And all along the way, there are people who get involved with Superman who have also lost their fathers or don't meet their fathers till later in life or don't know their life story.
The only guy more important to the Superman story than Jerry who wrote him was a guy named Jack Liebowitz who published him at DC Comics. And Jack Liebowitz had also not known his father, and he was looking for a hero too. So you've got a kid who invents a hero, an entrepreneur who gives this hero the market so America can see him in comic books, in comic strips, on radio, in cartoons, and on TV. And then you get the first TV Superman, George Reeves, who also was grown up and not known till he was in his 20s who his real father was. So two things are going on throughout Superman's history. One, you've got a sense of a character playing to what America needed, but the other is this much more personal, heartfelt story of a character playing to what his creators needed.
Well, and as Superman grows, and he literally evolves, he has to then go back in the comic book. He has to learn where he came from, and we all learn with him.
So with J.R. Tolkien, we're given the entire planet, the whole universe is there fully formed. With Superman, one of the wonderful things is it formed over time. It started out with a planet exploding, and we had no idea what really went on Krypton. Over time, the backstory gets filled in. We understand this is the ultimate orphan who is sent to Earth in a story that Jews think of as the perfect Exodus and Moses story and that Christians think of as a Christ story. Suddenly, he's got a cousin named Supergirl, and he's got a dog, and he's got all of these things that fill in around him. Every generation, his new handlers could fill in another piece. He starts by jumping and he ends up flying.
Let's go back to, though, how much Superman became for just about everybody who was involved in his creation, a hero for the Jews, a defender of the Jews.
I don't think it was accidental that the name that Superman came from Krypton with was Kal-El, which in Hebrew means the vessel of God. And it was not accidental that at a moment when the Holocaust was blowing up the Jewish world, the planet of Krypton blows up, and they had these things in Eastern Europe called kinder transports that were trying to save young Jewish kids. And Jerry Siegel had his hero saved on a kinder transport that brings him to Earth.
Well, you talk about how so many Jewish Americans became involved in the creation of Superman, and you trace all different ways in which you see this in a way to sort of have the power that they were not feeling in an America at this time, and certainly weren't feeling as Germany was marching. But was there a time decades later when there was almost a whiff of kind of an Aryan thing about Superman? I mean, he didn't start off with truth, justice, and the American way. That was added later. Was there a time when, it became something that might have made some Americans a little uncomfortable?
Very uncomfortable. That in Germany, in the Nazi era, Friedrich Nietzsche's Übermensch, his Superman, was the Aryan model. The idea of an American Superman made a lot of people uncomfortable, and yet there was a sense that even the SS recognized in the official SS newspaper, they attacked that scumbag Jew Jerry Siegel and his Jewish superhero. So there was something that our Superman was not quite Nietzsche's Übermensch, and that there was something more human about him. And to me, what it really was is that was the Clark Kent in Superman, that while he was this extraordinary hero, with most of his adventures, he prevailed because of his brain, not his brawn, and he was perpetually striving to understand the Clark Kent in his own humanness.
Yeah.
And he is today alive and well, and I think likely to last longer than either you or I does.
He has aged. You know, I mean, you see the early comics and you hear about these early radio shows. He was more boyish, didn't know that much about himself. He seems somewhat hardened by what he's seen over 75 years. Is he something of a father figure? Is he? I mean, you research what psychologists say about Superman. Is it too far to say that he has become the father figure that Jerry Siegel would have wanted?
I don't think it's too far. And as much as I trust psychologists, I trust your 9-year-old nephew more. We have all these fraught heroes like Spider-Man. We have dark heroes like Batman. But the clunky familiarity is something really comfortable, particularly in tough times, to go back to.
Well, and as you say, it's not just Superman. It's Clark as well. And, you know, many people probably have that point in their lives when they realize, wow, Dad is not perfect. You know, Superman is really Clark. But then again, Clark is also really Superman.
I love the notion that if somebody is insightful enough, they can look within me and see there's really a Superman there. He represents enough universal at the same time as enough fun that I think we keep going back to him.
Larry Tye, his exhaustive look at Superman. Is Superman the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero? Larry, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
And you thought Superman was just a cool guy with a cape. Larry Tye's book will be out in paperback next week. The new Superman film, Man of Steel, comes June 14th. Wear your party hat. This is the 75th anniversary of Superman. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.